Hello, mighty listeners, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where each week we celebrate the best of the worst, except for this week when we're celebrating the best of the best of the worst. Regular listeners will know that every now and again, myself and my co-host decide that you need a little shard of hope in the giant poisonous haystack of life. So that is why this week of all weeks, after the partial defeat of fascism in America and the absolute retreat against COVID in this country, that we thought you need a little bit of uplifting histories of five things we talked about in previous episodes. And joining me on this journey along the yellow brick road is my own beam of sunshine to my accidentally detonated nuclear bomb. It is Barry McStay.
The problem with having a shard of hope, of course, is that you can cut yourself quite badly on it.
Yes. Yeah, the shard of hope is the upside down publication that evil Barack Obama released in 2006.
Evil Barack Obama.
Evil Barack Obama.
I have to say, I said this already on Twitter. Woo boy, am I glad that the result of the election turned out the way it did. Not only just because we're defeating fascism, etc., but also because you and I just laid into the idea that Biden had won the election when we pre-recorded last week's episode of the podcast.
Look, I always say that opinion pollers are some of the most talented and fastidious people on earth, and they're never wrong.
We've not done world's worst opinion poll yet on the show. Anyone wants to make themselves known to us, the listeners will be glad to know there is no margin for error on this podcast. And Ben's right, occasionally we go back and look at an old episode or a bunch of old episodes, and look, instead of looking at what the worst of that topic is, we're looking at the best. And we are going back to episodes 46 to 50 this week, which are a long time ago, where we did world's worst cocktail, world's worst space invention, world's worst blaxploitation movie, world's worst greatest hits album, and world's worst messiah. I think we should start off with an aperitif.
We absolutely should. Would you like to go first as the teetotaler, or shall I?
No, I'll go first. Yeah, we had Rich Maxted, founder of Mix and Muddle, a cocktail company here in London, and actor and friend of ours, on the show.
Former flatmate of mine.
Former flatmate of Ben's, when we talked about World's Worst Cocktail. And I believe we picked Torpedo Fuel Filtered Through Bread, which Ben discovered that British submariners had consumed during the war. But, I mean, you could say any concoction of words and British submariners will have consumed it during the war, I imagine. but as you mentioned, Ben, I'm a teetotaler, and so I don't have much experience of drinking actual cocktails. So, of course, I've picked the Shirley Temple.
The Shirley Temple being a mocktail.
The mocktail, yeah. Shirley Temple is a non-alcoholic cocktail made of ginger ale and grenadine with a mascherino cherry. Or a maraschino cherry. I always say that wrong. I always think of Javier Mascherano, the midfielder.
A very industrious cherry, but it's a real box-to-box cherry.
Yeah, it doesn't have a stone in it. It's got a solid engine, though.
Yeah.
you can add some vodka or rum to produce a dirty Shirley, if you want, to make it a hard cocktail. Or if you add dark rum, it's a Shirley Temple Black, which is good naming because it's a homage to her actual married surname. She was married to a guy called Charles Black, the actress Shirley Temple was.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Crafty.
I mean, Shirley Temple is renowned for being a child star, right?
Yes, she made her film debut at the age of just three. In a film with other toddlers. It was a 1932 satire called Baby Burlesques, spelt E-S-K-S. And the kids wore adult clothing and diapers with safety pins, and their roles included prostitutes and World War One soldiers. Shirley Temple, in fairness to her, in her autobiography said, "It was a cynical exploitation of our childish innocence."
That's understatement of the year right there.
Yeah.
Come on, little Shirley, off to play school. What are we going to learn to be today? Today you're going to learn how to turn tricks.
And then tomorrow, it's the Psalm.
Yeah.
The thing it was amazing. She had an amazing career. Like, in 1934, it was the first, she was only six, and she was in the film Bright Eyes, which is the film that has On the Good Ship Lollipop is the song she's most famous for singing.
She's in it as a rabbit, right?
No, she is not in it as a rabbit. But she, her name is above the title in that. Like, at the age of six, it's Shirley Temple in Bright Eyes. And,
yeah, but it's not. But she doesn't get an and Shirley Temple or a with Shirley Temple.
I think if you're Ben Vanderveld in with someone else, that's pretty cool.
I mean, to be fair, that's how I wanted our wedding build.
Yeah.
I mean, more specifically, obviously, our wedding night.
To be clear to listeners, Ben and his wife's wedding, not our wedding. That would be, what a hell of a reveal that would be after 4 years of the podcast.
Where we get to 250 Patreon subscribers. Yeah. I will marry Barry McStay in what is potentially the world's first podcast wedding.
She won an Academy Award in February 1935 for her work during 1934, which is the year that she released this film, Bright Eyes. She was in 9 feature films that year and 2 shorts, and she was given a special Academy Award for her outstanding contribution to screen entertainment, a little pint-sized Academy Award, little tiny Oscar. And she was so famous. The level of fame for someone so young in an era where social media didn't exist is astonishing. She said she stopped believing in Santa Claus at the age of 6 after her mother took her to a department store to meet Santa and he asked her for her autograph. And on her 9th birthday in 1937, she received 135,000 presents from fans and people around the world, including a Jersey calf from school children in Oregon and a baby kangaroo from Australia. But she wasn't even the child of showbiz parents or anything like that. In fact, her mother, Gertrude, worked really hard to sort of look after her while she was growing up. She did her hair for her herself. She's famous for this like ringleted look. Her hair was 56 precisely golden curls for every job she appeared in. She met the Roosevelts when they were the first couple in America in the late 1930s, and Eleanor Roosevelt asked her if she wanted to use the swimming pool they had in their house, and Shirley Temple said no, she wanted to, but she couldn't knock her hair out because it took so long to get it put back in again. But the thing that really stood out for me is during her reign as a child star, there was a rumor in Europe that she was just an adult dwarf in disguise. The rumour was put to rest, you'll be glad to hear, when the Vatican sent a priest to verify that she was a little girl, which is the creepiest sentence I've ever read.
I mean, that is a remake of The Exorcist that, yeah, I think I would like to see.
Yeah. She retired from acting at the age of 22, and her later career is really interesting as well. If you don't know, she was active in the Republican Party in the 60s and supported the Vietnam War, so it was quite a conservative Republican, and she ran for Congress and lost. But she was a member of the US delegation to the UN. She was made the US ambassador to Ghana in the 70s. She was the first ever female chief of protocol in the United States, who's basically in charge of organizing state events. She organized the inauguration for Jimmy Carter. And in 1989, George H.W. Bush made her the US ambassador to Czechoslovakia as well. She was also diagnosed with breast cancer in her 40s at a time when people didn't really talk about breast cancer. And she publicly discussed the results of her mastectomy on radio and television in an article for a magazine.
Oh, wow.
She was president of the MS Society, founded the International Federation of Multiple Sclerosis Societies. Along with all, and she's not the only celebrity to have a non-alcoholic drink named after as well. There's a Roy Rogers, which is a cola and grenadine, and an Arnold Palmer as well, which is iced tea and lemonade. But yeah, the Shirley Temple is the one that I remember having as a child. it's way too sweet. And in fact, Shirley Temple said as much herself in 1986 in an interview. She said that saccharine sweet icky drink. Yeah, well. They were created in probably the middle 1930s by the Brown Derby restaurant in Hollywood, and I had nothing to do with it. But all over the world, I'm served that. People think it's funny. I hate them. And it's also one of those drinks that several different places have claimed to be the origin for it. The Brown Derby is one. Chasen's in West Hollywood is another. Royal Hawaiian Resort in Waikiki is another. But as a sort of a happy memory of being a child with adults having alcoholic drinks and being given what I felt was quite a grown-up drink, which was just some red ginger ale. I'm going to put forward the Shirley Temple.
I will let you know what my favourite cocktail is, which is an old-fashioned.
Oh, yeah.
And an old-fashioned is a whiskey-based drink, or bourbon-based drink, if you want to be incorrect.
But he's more of a Habsburg fan, though, mainly, Ben.
Yeah, the Habsburgs never made a... The problem with making a Habsburg spirit is that it would inevitably, instead of having a long nose on it, it'd have a very long chin.
Yeah.
And I was like, this tastes very... Is this corked? No, it's in bread.
I love that we're both... Well, there was a little moment there where we both decided, do we explain that joke? And then went, nah, the listeners to this show will know what that's all about.
Essentially, an old-fashioned is some bourbon or some whiskey with orangey flavours in, maybe some little bit of bitters. And the way to make it, it is the laziest cocktail in the world because it's just a big fuck-off lump of ice, 50 to 100 millilitres of the best whiskey you can find, depending on how much of an alcoholic you are. And the correct way to make it is just you squeeze the juices of the orange peel into it and just slowly stir it for about 10 minutes.
It's like Tortoise and the Hare stuff. You've got the flair cocktail maker beside you doing all of their tricks, and then you're just there with a long spoon stirring slowly a glass with some ice in it.
Mm-hmm, pretty much. And it's essentially, it's the reason it's called an old fashioned is because it's pretty old. It was probably made in the back end of the 18th, early 19th century. But by the mid 19th century, cocktails were becoming increasingly more sophisticated and full of garnishes and flourishes. And so people would start asking about that drink, you know, the old fashioned one. And old fashioned cocktails were quite often made with whiskey specifically. The other reason it became popular, it became popular during the Prohibition because it's got a nice sweet citrus flavour that it would be moderately easy to pass off as a non-alcoholic drink because it had that because it was sweetened whiskey. I also briefly looked up mint juleps just because it's got a good name, and in the similar way to the way that in the past people would drink beer instead of water because it was purer. Well, in the 18th and 19th century, a lot of cocktails were considered to have medicinal features as well. And the mint julep was one that southern farmers would drink instead of coffee in the morning because they believed it gave them an extra pep in their step. It's the mint julep is a cocktail that fits into your world as well because it gained worldwide fame when it became the official cocktail of the Kentucky Derby in 1938. Yeah. And nowadays you can get one in a golden cup for $1,000.
No, that sounds like you're just buying a golden cup and there happens to be some mint julep in it. Let's put, you're buying a golden cup, it costs $1,000. Then you go, okay, cool. Oh, there's a mint julep in it. If you're buying a mint julep, it costs $1,000.
Yeah, and it's a similar, it's sort of a mint julep is actually sort of a mix between a mojito and an old fashioned. It's bourbon, sugar, water, crushed ice, and fresh mint.
Yeah, it sounds refreshing. And,
yeah, it really is. I like the name, but julep is actually related to an old Persian word, galab, which means flavoured rose water.
Oh, now, you see, I always wondered if it was related to the word dewlaps, which makes it far less appealing sounding. You know, like bulldogs have that loose skin hanging off them? Like, those are dewlaps, like folds of skin hanging loose from the, like, the around the neck of an animal. So would you like a mint dewlap?
That's a mint cocktail served in a bulldog's jowls.
Yeah.
If you're buying, listeners, mine is an old-fashioned. But for I decided to go for hedonism and materialism for my choice and looked at some of the most expensive cocktails of all time. Mm-hmm. If you popped to the Merchant Hotel in Belfast, you could buy a Mai Tai for £750. And it is made with the same ingredients as the first ever Mai Tai, which was made in 1944. So it's
have they kept?
Well, you'll have to just go and spend a month's wages to find out, won't you?
You have a very optimistic vision of what my month's wages are at the moment.
But a lot of the most expensive cocktails of all time are done in this way of using very expensive ingredients. So there's one I found from 2014. I believe, called Salvatore's Legacy, and it was made at the Playboy Club in London. And Salvatore the Maestro Calabresi is an extremely well-known cocktail maker in that world, and he said, with his drink, I wish to be written within the pages of history. And he was using both some of the most expensive ingredients of all time and some of the oldest ingredients of all time. So, this cocktail cost £5,500.
Nope, no, it didn't. No, it didn't. No drink costs that much. I don't care how old the things are.
Be prepared to be more angry at the end of this story.
Okay. We couldn't allow ourselves 1 week to enjoy the election.
How old do you think the combined age of the ingredients are in it?
1,500 years.
You've slightly overrated it there. It's 730 years old.
Okay.
There is some Cloche de Griffier Vieux Cognac, which is from 1788, Orange Curaçao from the late 1860s, and 1770 Kummel Liqueur. And brilliantly, when they started making it, they dropped the cognac.
Good.
Yeah.
I hope the rats in the sewer below where it seeped down into had a lovely time.
Yeah, it was the rats from Ratatouille. You were like, quick, quick, we have to make this into tiramisu. And Calabresi said, when something gets smashed at a bar, it's normally cleaned up straight away. But in this case, everyone just stood looking at the puddle for 10 minutes. Should we try to sponge it up and filter the liquid? We mopped it up in the end. Funnily enough, the bartender who cleaned it away was stopped by the police on his way home and asked if he'd been drinking. So when it was made, all four bottles were opened up, and some of them had wax seals that had to be slowly melted and then opened with a sharp knife. Salvatore drank a thimbleful of each to see if the drink is still alive and can be used. And his response when asked was, "Mamma mia," because he is a cartoon character. And it was eventually made, and it was sampled by an unnamed guest who paid the £5,500, drank half of it,
and then
left for another event.
No. The world should burn.
But the most expensive one, and this is an unofficial world record, you can go to the Ritz-Carlton in Tokyo and order a Diamond is Forever martini for for 1.8 million yen,
okay,
which is about $18,000.
Okay.
All it is, chilled Grey Goose vodka with a hint of fresh lime, stirred or shaken. What puts this drink over the top? A crystal clear cut 1-carat diamond rests at the bottom of the glass. Plus, when you drink it, a band will serenade you with Diamonds Are Forever.
Oh, good. Like when you go to TGI Fridays and it's your birthday and they sing Happy Birthday. Cool.
Yeah, exactly that.
Oh, fuck off. You're buying a diamond with a drink around it. It's like the it's like the golden cup with mint julep in it earlier on. It's just bollocks. It's not the most expensive drink ever. You know what really annoys me as well? Is when you go to like a fancy restaurant and they make an expensive like Michelin star meal and you're paying like, 60 quid for a plate of food. And you go, you know what? I couldn't make this. I could make Grey Goose vodka with a squeeze of lemon in it. I could even put my wedding ring in it, which has a diamond in it, and then I've made the most expensive drink in the world. Where's my 1.8 million yen, please?
But could you source the diamond?
Yeah, it's on my fucking finger, which I'm giving to the camera right now.
Okay, and that's why I'm choosing the Old Fashioned as the greatest cocktail of all time.
Fair. And you know what? I'm completely on board with that decision. Next up, we talked about the world's worst space invention with Sam Baines, and we picked the two suit, the special spacesuit wherein two can become one. What did you find for a best space invention?
I'm sure I read a recent thing about the expedition to Mars and how it might have been NASA, it might have been the European Space Agency, were looking for an all-female crew because obviously one of the difficulties of travelling from Earth to Mars over a number of months, maybe a year, would be the impact on your sex life. And so this article put forward, if we have an all-female crew, that won't be a problem. And the person who retweeted this then put on their tweet, "Looks to the camera in space, lesbian." Which I think is an extremely fair critique.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, we need to get this back on track and be sensible. So, quail eggs. In 2001, NASA, along with a Japanese technology company, developed the Avian Development Facility, which is a pair of centrifuges that houses a rotating cast of 36 Japanese quail eggs to better understand how space affects embryo development. And apparently bird eggs are ideally suited for microgravity research because they're self-contained, they're self-sustaining, and they don't have any relationship with their mother yet. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's all sorts of things to deal with. I presume eggs have amniotic fluid in, that's what the egg is? I don't know. But I just like the idea of space quails rotating around in what is clearly the slowest fry-up in the entire galaxy.
Yeah. Quails in space.
So I think I'm just going to go for that one, to be honest.
Just a quail egg centrifuge.
a quail egg centrifuge. It really does sound like something that NASA were like, don't tell Blumenthal. He can't know about it. The moment we've made it, he'll want it for one of his fucking restaurants.
Yeah, that seems fair. All right. Quail egg. I thought mine was going to be stupid, but all right, fair enough. Listen, in 1958, when NASA was created, Congress required it to share information about its discoveries. There are loads of breakthroughs in medicine and other areas of science thanks to NASA, because NASA has to share what it discovers. It publishes an annual spin-off report about the commercial uses of its inventions. For example, it didn't invent MRI, but the Jet Propulsion Lab developed digital image processing to enhance pictures of the moon and stuff like that, which helped improve MRI and CAT scans. In 1995, engineers at the Johnson Space Center in Houston worked to help develop the left ventricular assist device, which is an artificial heart pump based on the space shuttle's fuel pumps. So it's used to help keep people healthy while they're waiting for a heart transplant, and occasionally can replace the need for a transplant altogether. Even more recently, they also help sponsor successful clinical trials on the medical uses of a light technology, which helps to reduce the painful side effects of chemotherapy and radiation treatment in cancer patients who have bone marrow or stem cell transplants. The light technology was originally developed to help with plant experiments on the space shuttle. The NASA's also helped contribute to ear thermometers, insulin pumps, heart defibrillators, and mammograms as well. But I saw the word space invention and immediately thought of space hoppers. So... One of the things on the show that I sort of really enjoy is that you don't ever think of someone must have invented the space hopper. But yep. Obviously someone did, and that guy was Aquilino Cossani of La Dragoma, which is an Italian company. He invented it in 1968. Originally it was called a pon-pon, and has lots of different names all over the world, including moon hopper, kangaroo ball, bouncer. I think Americans call it a hippity-hop or a hoppity-hip or a sit-and-bounce.
Well, it depends what direction it's going. If it's going forwards, it's a hippity hop. If it's going backwards, it's a hoppity hip.
In Netherlands, rather pleasingly, they called it a skippy ball. They were introduced in the UK in 1969, and really, they were ever present in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. I feel they've been slightly ruined by the fact that like, exercise balls have become really mainstream. It's sort of slightly demeaned and diluted the joy of the original space hopper. And have you seen the original ones? They're like the little orangey yellow ones with the sort of... They've got quite long... floppy ears which you grab onto and a sort of a rabbity looking face on the front of them.
I mean, a couple of things to unpack there. Firstly, the notion that the original space hopper has been demeaned in any way.
Yeah, no, definitely.
You make it sound like a rather, you know, you make it sound like the space hopper is the member of parliament for Carmarthenshire. And it's those, in my mind, they were never ears. They were horns that you were holding on to.
I always thought they were sort of rabbits. I sort of had the image of a rabbit, and so they're rabbit ears.
What, seriously overweight rabbits?
Yeah. They've appeared on TV. They've appeared in Friends, the comic strip Presents, Endeavor. They are used in a couple of emotes in the video game Fortnite. And they can also be seen in the background of a scene of episode 59 of the original series of Star Trek. Not only that, there's a pornographic parody film called Bat Pussy from 1973 where the titular character of Bat Pussy uses a space hopper for transportation. And my favourite thing of all, in 2018, a British man called Stephen Payne completed the first crossing of the Alps by space hopper from Bardonezia in Italy to Grenoble in France, a world record journey of 75 miles or 122 kilometres, which took him 19 days.
I really hope that as a reward, he's been given a yellow jersey with the face of the space hopper on the front.
I then looked him up, because that was just sort of a byline in an article about space hoppers. And so I looked him up, and there's an interview with him in The Guardian. And how it came about is remarkable. In 2015, he said his life was turned upside down. His father died, he was made redundant, he split up with his fiancée, and was diagnosed in leukemia, all in the space of 3 months. And so he had to sell his home and think about how he could, like, rebuild his life. No job, no house, no relationship. He ended up spending, like, trying to fill his time, and he ended up researching 14th century pilgrimages, as you do.
Barry, when you say, as you do, as that is the sort do. Of thing yes. that we would do.
Yeah, and indeed have done. He said he's not religious, but he thought a 200-mile walk across the south of England would be a nice way to sort of escape from his troubles. So he did that. Then he made another trip where he travelled through Wales in a coracle. And he was also spending time helping out with local homeless people in Chichester, where he lived. And he took his homeless friend Paul for a meal one day. And Paul was talking about how difficult it was to get a permanent address and find a job. And he said, it's virtually impossible. It's like trying to cross the Alps on a space hopper. And he thought, that's it. Don't be stupid, said Paul. You'll die. It's not going to happen. So then I had to do it, said Stephen.
Oh, no.
He bought a 1970 space hopper on eBay. He spent the winter into the spring practicing it, realizing that he should have a child-sized space hopper because they're slightly easier for slopes than a bigger one, which is better suited to flat. He researched his routes, found the route between Bardonecchi and Grenoble, so he set off in a tweed suit to avoid insect bites and a pith helmet to keep the sun off his neck. But even by noon on the first day, it was 30 degrees centigrade, and he had to pause every 10 bounces to make sure he didn't get cramp. Factoring in a siesta every day, making sure there was a B&B en route. And he was travelling at half a mile an hour, 8 or 9 hours a day, but occasionally still had to sleep rough because he didn't make it to his target place. Suffered heat stroke, altitude sickness, and then nearing the end, he then twisted his knee, and a hiker helped him bandage it up, and he pressed on, and eventually got to Grenoble in some agony, with a big Facebook following his every update as he went along. And then when he got back to Chester, he seized up completely and spent 5 days on his hands and knees from the pain of it. But well done him.
Yeah, that's astonishing. And did he raise money for charity doing it?
He used it to promote the idea of helping the homeless, because he said he was working with the homeless people. The reason he'd done it was inspired by his chat with homeless people. So he said anyone who was interested in, you know, doing anything to support him, they should donate to homeless charities and things like that. What a nice way to use a space hopper.
Yeah, it really is. Well, I mean, I think that how could we deny the humble space hopper its place in immortality after a story like that?
Absolutely.
And one day, who knows, Elon Musk might be able to supercharge a space hopper so you too can hop to the moon.
The Hopper X.
Yes.
Next up, we talked about the world's worst blaxploitation movie with Masoud Milas. And we picked Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, I believe. Both of us confessed at the time not to know a great deal about blaxploitation movies. Masoud did a lot of the heavy lifting on that episode. But one of the blaxploitation movies I had heard of before the show was Foxy Brown. And one of the blaxploitation stars I had heard of was Pam Grier. So I've decided to talk about Pam Grier and Foxy Brown. So Pam Grier, if anyone doesn't know her, she's also the star of Jackie Brown, the Quentin Tarantino mm-hmm. film, which is based on a book. And the heroine of that book is white. But when he was thinking of how to adapt it for the screen, Tarantino said he basically had one person in mind. It was Pam Grier. And she was one of the only female leads in blaxploitation movies in the 70s. And she said that she took the roles available to black women at the time, which weren't many, and she said she somehow ended up on top. She was so powerful a screen presence that she was then able to taking crap roles like, you know, prostitution, all of the stereotypical shit roles that there were for actresses at the time, particularly black actresses. She was eventually able to gain more autonomy, have say in how her characters were portrayed. She was able to, you know, say she wanted less sex and nudity in several of her films, and she wanted to be them to be less violent or less racist. And she said herself, some people remark that blaxploitation movies are exploitative, and indeed some of them were, but she said, why would people think I would ever demean the black woman? I was tried and convicted without ever being asked to testify in my defense. Sure, a lot of those films are junk, but they were what was being offered. They provided work for me and jobs for hundreds of blacks. We all needed to work, we all needed to eat. The 1970s were a time of freedom and women saying that they needed empowerment. There was more empowerment and self-discovery than any other decade I remember. All across the country, a lot of women were Foxy Brown and Coffee. They were independent, fighting to save their families, not accepting rape or being victimized. This is going on all across the country. I just happened to do it on film. I don't think it took any great genius or great imagination. I just exemplified it, reflecting it to society. And indeed, she did. I mean, Foxy Brown and Coffee are both sort of revenge movies. The plot of Foxy Brown is she's the title character, Foxy Brown, described as a whole lot of woman, who showcases her unrelenting sexiness while battling the film's villains. Her boyfriend is a government agent. He's shot down by members of a drug syndicate, and she sets out to seek revenge upon them. So it's a female-driven action movie.
Which is a rarity now, even more so then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think she may well have been pretty much the first one. And Coffee is a similar thing. In the opening sequence of Coffee, she whips out a sawn-off shotgun and blows a guy's head off. Foxy Brown has that famous image of her pulling a small pistol out of her afro at the end of the movie. they're problematic movies in many ways, but at the time, they're subverting the action movie genre. She said she had to bump heads with a lot of men in the industry that weren't comfortable showing a progressive black female in an action role. She was a strong woman. Certain people said, oh, you're taking our jobs, you're castrating men. And she said, as far as I'm concerned, we don't need to walk behind you, we should walk beside you. Hmm. And not only is she sort of a trailblazer in that sense, but she's also quite a hell of a person. Along the sort of lines of Shirley Temple, her latter career, which people might know less about, is just as interesting. She's got an honorary doctorate from the University of Maryland, Eastern Shore. She's got an honorary doctorate of science from Langston University. She founded the Pam Grier Community Garden and Education Center with the National Multicultural Western Heritage Museum. She starred in The L Word, a lesbian TV drama in the 2000s. And she said, in interviews about it, you can't control DNA. So if we're all these wonderful gifts and miracles, aren't gay people miracles too? Or are there selective miracles? I try to make people think about what the fuck they say. I ask them where they got their logic from. Think. I guess that's where my badassness is. She's an ally. And not only that, she now lives on a ranch in Colorado caring for abandoned and mistreated horses. How could I not love her?
That's magnificent. We're going for Pam Grier generally and Foxy Brown
as the epitome. Yeah.
Okay, very nice. So I'm going for a movie that is not technically a blaxploitation movie, but falls so much within the remit of it. It's almost like parallel evolution. So my choice is a movie called The Harder They Come.
Okay.
Which, do you know what? I may have even talked about it before, but it is the first feature film fully produced by Jamaicans.
Okay.
And it was filmed over a three-year period from 1969 to 1972, and it stars Jimmy Cliff, and it launched his international career. It, in many ways, actually probably owes as much to the aesthetics of Nollywood-style films as much as blaxploitation films, but it is very much about a criminal underworld where there is a criminal folk hero who is celebrated perhaps more than he should be. There is morally dubious in many places, but then again, as was the argument with blaxploitation movies, these characters had to become the heroes because often there was nowhere else to find role models when the man was getting them down. Most of all, it has, for me, growing up, loving reggae as I did, the most astonishing soundtrack. Obviously, Jimmy Cliff sings on it a lot. It's got You Can Get It If You Really Want.
Oh,
it's got The Harder They Come, which is a great song as well. It's got The Israelites on. The Rivers of Babylon first makes its appearance there. Toots and the Maytals are on there. And best of all, it's got Many Rivers to Cross, which is just about the best gospel reggae crossover. I would put the vocal of that toe-to-toe with any vocal ever recorded. It is that goddamn good. And I want to tell you a little bit about the backstory of the person who it is based on. The main character Jimmy plays is Ivanhoe Martin. And he was inspired by a criminal from the 40s called Vincent Ivanhoe Martin, whose nickname is also Raging, which I'm extraordinarily mispronouncing as Jamaican patois for raging. but it's spelled R-H-Y-G-I-N-G. And he was seen as being the original rude boy. And he was celebrated in the same sort of way as Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde were. So really very bad people indeed. But when you're living in the ghetto and you've got sod all, you can see why someone who is charismatic and giving it back to the police is going to become a folk hero. He had a couple of other nicknames. He was also nicknamed himself Alan Ladd and Captain Midnight. And he was arrested in 1946 for armed robbery. And he began a career of self-dramatization by defending himself in court. But apparently he irritated the judge with his long-winded and grandiose speeches. He very charismatic. He was like this little 5'2", 5'3" fella, but kind of like stocky and this megawatt charisma that made people kind of like him. But his most famous crime spree is pretty grim. The police tried to capture him, they learned from an informer that he was at the Carib Hotel and they sent officers after him. He was in a room with a woman when the police burst in. He grabbed his gun, managed to shoot his way out, leaving one officer dead, two other wounded. The killing of Detective Lewis led the mayor of Kingston, a chap called Alexander Bustamante, to launch a major manhunt. The following day, Martin killed a woman who was the girlfriend of the man he believed had informed on him. He also shot two other women who were in the room at the time, wounding them. And immediately after, the police said, right, £200 reward for him, dead or alive. And this tells you something about the age that he lived in. In response to this, he wrote an open letter to one of the detectives leading the search for him. It was published the next day in the Jamaica Times, stating, I have an arsenal of 29 shots and I'm satisfied that I have made history for the criminal element in Jamaica. Don't think that I'm going to kill myself because this will only serve to spoil my great record. But I hope that Detective Scott will train his men some more. I'm going to show the police force what is lacking and what I can do. This was a number of series of letters that he wrote in the paper to sort of goad the police. And eventually, the manhunt ended on the 9th of September 1948. And at the age of just 24, he was killed after an hour-long gunfight.
Young people today have lost the letter-writing ability of old, haven't they?
He very quickly turned into a Jamaican folklore because partially because of his swagger and his he had this sort of will-o'-the-wisp element to him, able to appear and disappear at will. And he was commemorated by Jamaican comedians Bim and Bam in a drama called Reagan's Ghost. He was on a B-side of Prince Buster's single, Ten Commandments. For them that know, Prince Buster, one of the greatest ska DJs of all time, and was also the subject of a Jamaican patois poem called Dead Man by Louise Bennett Coverley, a pretty famous Jamaican poet. But obviously he was most famously immortalized by Jimmy Cliff in this film. And just to give you an idea of how popular The Harder They Come was, when it was first screened at the Carib Cinema on June the 1st, 1972, the cinema could only hold 1,500 people. 40,000 people turned up to watch the film and were literally cheering every moment in the film when Jimmy Cliff's character took it to the man. And it regularly appears in lists of some of the greatest movies of all time. And just in terms of its rawness, its realness, its excitement, and the fact that it has one of the best soundtracks of all time, I've got to choose it. Two last words. It was resurrected as a stage version at the Stratford Theatre Royal in London in 2006 and went on to become the theatre's most successful play. And Perry Hensel, who is one of the writers of the film, describes it as, I had a choice when I set out, to make a film for Jamaicans or for the rest of the world. I chose to make a film for Jamaica.
Nice.
What do you reckon? Do you want to go for the most important movie in Jamaica's history or Pam Grier's Foxy Brown?
Ooh, I mean, I feel like we shouldn't choose.
It's all right. We're allowed to have opinion on cultures that are not our own. They're both excellent choices.
I feel they should be better informed opinions.
All right. Well, I think my opinion is better formed than yours, and I'm going to pick The Harder They Come.
Okay, fair enough. Next up, we did the world's worst greatest hits album with comedian Tom Tuck, and I believe we picked Radiohead's greatest hits. Why don't you go first on this one?
Do you know what? Because I think I know what yours is going to be. In fact, I'd be willing to bet vast sums of money that aren't mine. I found this a tricky one to decide upon because I recently listened to a podcast all about the Beatles' Red Album and Blue Album, which are their two best of albums that were released, I think, at the back end of the 60s, start of the 70s. And they're good and they're fun if you don't have the albums or if you're a child being introduced to them. But I never had those in my house, so I'm not going down the Beatles route. Mm-hmm. I'm going to briefly talk about Verve Records. Now, Verve is the record label founded in 1956 that is home to the world's largest jazz catalogue. And it has artists like Ella, Nina Simone, Stan Getz, Billie Holiday, Oscar Peterson. And growing up, my dad had various Verve Presents ... albums. That is where I got my jazz education from. And I...
That's what Ben calls reading history books while smoking a joint.
Yeah. No, the thing with jazz education and jazz history is that it's all about the years you don't read about.
It's about the years in between 1066 and the Great Fire of London.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, you do syncopated counting, so you just miss some out.
Yeah.
Obviously, British history, we've done some very syncopated counting and missing out all years between 1588 and 1939. And it's impossible to pick one. And I'm mostly frustrated because when I had a big CD cull, when I say I, when it was enforced by my wife, because she was like, you don't need these old-fashioned things anymore, I presumed the Verve Record stuff would be on Spotify, and they're not.
Oh.
So I've lost these great best-ofs. I think the Ella Fitzgerald one was probably my most treasured one, either that or the Duke Ellington one. And it's the Ella one has a special place in my heart for now, because I've just introduced my son to Ella Fitzgerald and he loves her.
Aww.
Yeah, this morning he was like, Daddy, play the Manhattan song.
Bless him, he's going to be such a precocious little shit.
Going to be. I also thought about that this is not a band that is anywhere near as titanically large a name as any of the Verve Record selections or my choice, but the Lightning Seeds best of album is just perfect. They are a hugely underrated creators of masterful pop music.
Yeah.
Particularly any non-British listeners, because the Lightning Seeds you might not have heard of. They're from Liverpool and they write perfect 4-minute pop songs. I was tempted to go for Legend by Bob Marley because, again, I grew up listening to loads of reggae. And the thing about Legend is it's got some good songs on it, but it was never anywhere near my favourite Bob Marley album because it's got I Shot the Sheriff on, which I don't particularly like. And it was very much an album of Island Records going, hey, white people, come listen to this guy without any politics. And I much preferred his albums called... Exodus is his famous one. I think my favourite one is probably... I like Survival and I like Rastaman Vibration. But the thing is, a little Jewish guy wandering around his private school, age 14, singing Rastaman Vibration and Africa Unite. Like, you can see why I got bullied a lot. A thing I didn't know about it, remarkably, it has spent, as of January this year, it has spent a total of 609 non-consecutive weeks on the Billboard 200 album chart, the second longest in history.
Was this Legend? And
this is Legend.
Yeah.
And as of July, it spent 932 weeks in the top 100 of the UK albums chart, the third longest in history.
It's at 950 now.
Wow.
And I think it's actually the second longest in history in the UK.
Yeah,
after ABBA, Gold.
Ugh. Well, there's also in America, I think it's Dark Side of the Moon has got the title at 1574 weeks. But my choice is going to be another record that I listened to over and over again as a kid, and it is the best of Kiss.
Yeah.
I remember discovering my brother's little tape of the best of Kiss, and I would literally alternate between the going to the zoo tapes, Simpsons Sing the Blues, and the best of Kiss.
So as a little Jewish kid wandering around your private school, instead of singing Africa Unite, you were in black and white goth makeup and leathers.
Yeah, singing Crazy, Crazy Nights.
Yeah.
And I Want to Be Your Lover.
Yeah. and the bullying stopped.
Mate, it was black and white makeup. They couldn't touch me. Kiss's logo has been had to be altered in several countries because their lightning S's look far too much like the SS insignia.
Yeah, I have often thought that.
Other things that I learned about them that I love, obviously, Kiss put merch everywhere. You can have a Kiss casket. They've owned football league teams. They've owned ice hockey teams. Like, you can put a logo on it. Kiss have manufactured it. But my favourite thing is that they starred in a Marvel comic book taking on Doctor Doom, and the red ink used in their very first comic book contains blood from all of the members mixed into it.
Oh, that is the most Kiss thing I've ever heard.
Isn't it? So, I adored them. Then I got into Bill and Ted. Then I got into, you know, Van Halen and Iron Maiden and Gunners. And when was it, 2 or 3 years ago, I got to take my wife to watch Kiss on our anniversary, which is one of my greatest achievements as a husband ever.
That is astonishing work.
It's Queen, isn't it?
It is Queen. Obviously, it's Queen. I mean, there's no other argument about this. The greatest Queen, greatest hits is obviously the greatest hits album there's ever been. Yes, as Ben meant, I think I read the same article you did about Bob Marley, Bob Marley's legend. Queen is third on that list of the longest serving albums in the UK top 100 charts. It's 916 weeks in the album charts in the UK it's spent. This is Greatest Hits, because Greatest Hits 2 is also a frequent appearer in the top 100 charts here in the UK. In fact, at the moment, because I did check before the podcast, Queen Greatest Hits is number 20 in the UK album charts, nearly 40 years after it was released. Live Around the World, their album with Adam Lambert, is at 26, and the Platinum Collection, which contains Greatest Hits 1, 2, and 3, is at 61.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, Queen Greatest Hits 3 is very much, it's the Godfather 3 rather than the Toy Story 3.
Yeah,
it's quite a drop off.
It's the one where they shoved I'm in Love with My Car onto it.
I love Roger,
Roger Taylor stuff rather's on it.
You like that.
I'm a Queen apologist and I don't like it.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I don't adore it. I'm not going to stand up for it in any real sense. But my issue with that is not that. It's all of the Made in Heaven stuff, which is not vintage Queen, is it?
Yeah, all of the Freddy's Dead, We've Got to Mourn stuff. yeah, it's the best-selling album in the UK ever, ahead of ABBA Gold. It has sold over 6 million albums. One in four UK households has a copy of Queen Greatest Hits 1. Greatest Hits 2 has sold nearly 4 million and is 10th on that list. So that's 10 million copies of those two Queen albums across the UK. Those figures, by the way, include 50% of sales of box sets which contain both of these albums, and 33% of sales of box sets which contain all three Queen Greatest Hits albums, which means there are even more copies of those albums out there in the country as well. It's up there in America. Actually, the Eagles' Greatest Hits, 1971-75, is the best-selling album ever in the United States. It sold over 38 million copies, and Elton John's Greatest Hits is the best-selling solo album.
I will laud Americans and congratulate them for having Elton John up there. The Eagles are a band that I cannot get on board with. Like, basically, they should have started and stopped with Hotel California. there's a scene in The Big Lebowski where a taxi driver is driving the dude home after he's had quite the day, and he asks him to turn the Eagles off because he hates them, and the taxi driver angrily rips him out the back seat. Like, my goddamn taxi, I will listen to what I want, but I agree with the dude.
Yeah.
I will stand with him on that. The Eagles are absolutely turgid.
It's very telling when their Greatest Hits album is from the years 1971-75 only. Queen's Greatest Hits also has worldwide sales of 25 million copies, and it was released in 1981 alongside Under Pressure. And it has no universal track listing. The track listing is different depending on what country you bought the album in. Some of the albums had Under Pressure on it, but they'd pressed the album mostly in the UK, so the release over here didn't have that on it. It's the first track on Greatest Hits 2. I think this is the UK track listing from the original release. Any album that has Bohemian Rhapsody, Another One Bites the Dust, Killer Queen, Fat Bottom Girls, Bicycle Race, You Are My Best Friend, Don't Stop Me Now, Save Me, Crazy Little Thing Called Love, Somebody to Love, Now I'm Here, Good Old Fashioned Lover Boy, Play the Game, Flash, Seven Seas of Rye, We Will Rock You, and We Are the Champions. And that's leaving out a hell of a lot of other songs which appear on Greatest Hits 2.
What I love about it is it doesn't let up.
It's amazing. Brilliantly compiled. Like, as a Greatest Hits album, it's not chronologically compiled. They've thought about, like, the journey it's going to take you on. Launches in with Bohemian Rhapsody, and then takes on a bit of a journey through some of the earlier stuff, and then gets to the grander stuff. We Will Rock You and We Are the Champion are the showstoppers at the end of it, along with Seven Seas of Rye.
But what I love about the end of it is that any band on earth would end their set with We Will Rock You, and the fact that Queen can go, yeah, we got another one.
Yeah, right. And the amazing thing was, at the time of its release, in the NME, the News Musical Express, Barney Hoskins, who was one of the reviewer, said, all of their songs, besides Another One Bites the Dust, are quite repulsive, unbelievably crass insults to their respective genres, and uniformly vulgar music. It was only when Queen took vulgarity to its absolute limit that they stood out. And in Melody Maker, another reviewer, Adam Sweeting, said, I've never been the slightest bit interested in Queen's ridiculous pomposity, and Freddie just makes me snigger. But I suppose songs like Killer Queen are sort of catchy, while anything as preposterous as We Will Rock You deserves an award, if only for bad taste. Which goes to show that pollsters and reviewers know fuck all.
Yeah, well, it's true. Queen were always reviled by the British press. Like, one thing that makes me very proud of being British is that the ridiculous pomposity of Queen is something that most British people feel in their core. I mean, it is essentially the sound of Kipling's Empire delivered by a gay Indian.
Yeah, it's just it's unabashed and so full of self-belief and innovative. Like, Bohemian Rhapsody is the obvious one, but they're doing a lot of really interesting standout stuff at the forefront of when it existed. Yeah, it fell out of fashion because punk came along. I mean, there's a reason Live Aid is considered such a pinnacle moment, because it suddenly reminded people how fucking amazing a live band they were.
Exactly. They're so powerful. And the thing is, sure, punk was a bit of a reaction to them, but it was more of a reaction to Marillion and yes, to Rick Wakeman.
Yeah. So obviously, I don't care what you say, Ben, we're going to pick Queen Greatest Hits 1.
I don't care what I say either, we're going to pick Queen's Greatest Hits 1.
Okay, fine. Obviously. I'm glad you also knew that was the correct answer and left that lane open for me.
Like, no, like, to be honest, I was just like, I'm going to say some things. They are, I essentially, my contribution to this section of the show was the same as the contribution made by the New Zealand Conservative Party in the election last month. They're like, we're going to get our asses paddled, but we got to show up.
Our final topic that we discussed in episode 50 was the world's worst messiah, with your friend Ben, Sam Liebens, and we picked Moses of Crete, a Moses-alike false prophet who said he could lead his followers across the Mediterranean from Crete to the Promised Land, walked a few people into the sea to drown, and when some of them got back to the shore, he had stolen their stuff.
What an absolute shit.
Yeah, I've gone for my best messiah being Handel's messiah. Of course. Ben is rolling his eyes up here.
It's not as good as Queen's Greatest Hits Volume 1, though, is it?
I mean, nothing is, let's be honest. But I bet if George II had heard Bohemian Rhapsody, he would have stood during that as well. If anyone hasn't been to a performance of Messiah, the audience are meant to stand during the Hallelujah chorus. And apparently that originated during the first performance that George II saw, and he was so moved by it. Or apparently may have just been a bit stiff, because it is at the end of Act 2. He stood up at that point in the concert, and now the tradition goes that everyone stands up. He's also not the only person who was moved to react when he saw and heard it performed. During the first performance of it, Dr. Patrick Delaney, the Chancellor of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, heard Susanna Cibber singing during it. He heard her sing the words, "He was despised," and he proclaimed, "Woman, for this ought be all thy sins forgiven thee." She was undergoing a quite a rowdy divorce at the time. I think we've talked about it on the show before, from an actor called Theophilus Cibber, and there was like a menage a trois, there was kidnapping going on. Composed by Handel in 1741. Mm-hmm. It's an oratorio, so Handel had mainly done operas. And then opera was beginning to fall out of fashion, and it was expensive to produce, and he wasn't able to have the full creative control over it that he would have liked. So he moved to doing oratorios, which are sort of smaller pieces and a bit more easily staged and so on. So he wrote the music, and the scriptural text was compiled by a guy called Charles Jennens, where he's got lots of Old Testament stuff and some New Testament stuff. It's basically Christ from birth to death. And it was performed at Easter originally. It's now a Christmas piece, but it sort of spans his life. And this guy Jennens actually uses a lot of lines from the Old Testament in it, and applies like quotes from the Old Testament, which aren't necessarily about Christ. But apparently he was in a battle at the time. There was a religious sect called the Deists who denied that prophecy was a trait of the Bibles. So Jennens was picking bits and pieces out of the Old Testament that he could put together to make it look like it had predicted Christ.
But he's sort of doing a back, not back explanation, but a back prediction.
Yeah, like imagine someone picking out the words "he will rise" about someone getting up out of bed and then going, but because it's in the book before Jesus arrives, it's actually about Jesus. It's doing things like that. Handel went to Dublin to produce the first performance of it because he'd had a few failures in London, and he basically decided he wanted to try it out of town.
And it was his most, like, previews.
Yeah, he's got to do it. Yeah, he's got to test it. So it was first performed in Dublin, 13th of April, 1742, at the Music Hall on Fishamble Street. Received its first London premiere nearly a year later. He wrote it for quite a small performance group. It's like a small group of singers, maybe 15 or 20, and a small number of instruments. It's now grown into this thing where you have massive orchestras and huge choirs singing it and all sorts of things. And that's largely thanks to the Victorians. they'd fill the Crystal Palace with thousands of singers and hundreds of musicians. So a single performance of it could take 5 hours with a dinner break.
The thing with Victorian Entertainment, they were like, we've got a lot of time to fill.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Do you reckon Victorian audiences sort of vegged out in front of opera in the way that we veg out in front of telly?
I think they would wander in and out. Probably like go and make a cup of tea and come back. What's happened while I left? All of that stuff.
Yeah.
And if anyone doesn't know and hasn't heard it, it's not a dramatic piece. There's no direct speech. It's sort of like a reflection on Jesus as the Messiah. Looks at prophecies and then the Annunciation to the shepherds and then the birth of Christ and the Passion and the Resurrection and all of that stuff.
Sorry, when you said a reflection on Jesus as the Messiah, you make it sound like a performance review.
Yes.
So Jesus, we brought you in here and we have to say we think you're doing very well. Excellent on the leprosy curing quota. Very good, very popular.
But please
at the
stop tinkering with the water cooler.
Yeah. And I have to say the accounts department is very angry with your reorganization of their desks.
Yeah. Apparently, at this first performance, they had 700 people at the music hall, and management pleaded with people in advance that ladies should wear dresses without hoops in order to make room for more people to cram into it. It was such excitement about the performance. But Handel, I didn't know this, a really good guy. He gave his fee from the Dublin performance to a debtor's prison in a hospital. The first performance came in London a few months later. Audiences were a bit iffy about it being performed in a theatre. But then the following year, he held a performance at the Foundling Hospital. Handel himself went on to conduct Messiah in London twice every year as an annual benefit concert for the Foundling Hospital. So he was raising money every year to do it. And he went on to become a governor of the hospital, left it a copy of the score in his will. When he died, he had like £20,000. He made him a millionaire when he died. And he left much of his fortune to charities and to friends and servants. And his only sort of big posthumous gesture to himself was he paid £600 for a monument to himself in Westminster Abbey.
That's quite self-aggrandizing, but I like that.
I think he had earned that by all of the family hospital stuff and so on. And yeah, apparently he even went to a performance of it 8 days before he died. He went to a performance of it at the Theatre Royal in Covent Garden. And he managed to sort of find a niche for it. There was a lot of Easter music at the time. Bach had written a St. Matthew's Passion, which was really popular. And there wasn't a lot of big oratorios or sacral music for Christmas. And so even though Messiah was an Easter thing originally, the fact that it had so much of Christ's birth in it meant it could also work at Christmas and found its niche there. And maybe the greatest compliment to it of all kind is that Mozart thought Messiah was so brilliant he had a go at reorchestrating it in 1789, but said that any things that he did, any alterations he made, should not be interpreted as an effort to improve the music. He said, Handel knows better than any of us what will make an effect. When he chooses, he strikes like a thunderbolt. So,
wow.
When Mozart himself thinks Messiah is that good, who are we to argue with Mozart, Ben?
Well, Wolfie, sit back down and let me talk to you about Ryuho Okawa,
okay.
The CEO and founder of the Happy Science religious organization.
I'm already suspicious.
Has declared himself, amongst others, as the reincarnated consciousness of Buddha, but in many interviews throws in Jesus, Moses, Muhammad, like whoever you want, Vishnu, I've got all of them for you. He has reportedly published over 500 books, many of which are just transcripts of video lectures. Some of them have got some cracking names. The Laws of the Sun, The Laws of Eternity, The Terrifying Revelations of Nostradamus, Hermes, Winds of Love, The Final Judgment, I'm Fine, My Angel, The World We Live In, and Daybreak. And listen, he's mostly, if not entirely, the wronging leader of a Japanese cult. But I just like the fact that with him, you get more messiahs for your buck than with many others.
He sounds like, I mean, he's got Nostradamus in there, he's got Hermes, he's got a bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Fine, My Angel also sounds like the reaction of someone when the angel of death appears and they go, come on, it's your time. I'm fine, my angel. No, I'm not finished yet. I know I'd put my cutlery down, but it doesn't mean I'm actually finished here on Earth.
I can imagine the angel of death turning up for Sean Connery a couple of weeks ago and him going, not now, I'm too busy.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for my suggestion, I'm going to pick the year 2239 to 2240. Any thoughts on what I'm doing there?
Now, I have a vague memory that that's around the time when Captain Kirk is meant to be born.
I mean, that would be a lovely piece of synchronicity, but no.
Okay.
So in Jewish Talmudic tradition, there will not be a Messiah. There will be a coming of the Messianic age. And the notion is that that age will begin at its latest. We've got a deadline, and Jews apparently work well to a deadline, of the year 6000 in the Hebrew calendar. The notion being, of course, that in a week you have 6 days on which to work and a seventh day of rest and peace and contemplation. And the seventh millennium will be that. There's no real chat about what will happen at the end of that millennium into the eighth millennium. But that corresponds to the year in our calendar, 29th of September, 2239, until the 16th of September, 2240.
Clear your calendars, folks.
Yeah, clear your calendars, because it's going to be deck chairs at dawn. And I think the notion of a Messiah as one individual who can save us all is, like most of religion, fucking infantile. But I think the notion of a messianic age where finally we go, right, we've learned and developed to a greater stage of human knowledge and behavior that we can look out for each other a little bit more and be more mindful of each other is also quite infantile, but slightly better.
Is that what's due to happen then? We've got to wait 219 years before we finally cop on and realize that's what we should have been doing this whole time.
Pretty much. I mean, yeah, and Resurrection of the Dead and Angels Down on Earth and Gates of Wisdom on High.
I was worried there wouldn't be any of the Laser and Light Show, but that's cool. I'm glad.
Yeah. Lions and Lambs, Freddie will be headlining, all that shit.
I am so here for this.
Yeah. Mate, Catholic, not invited. I mean, fuck it, you can do the catering.
I mean, sorry, I just want to point out that Freddie was Zoroastrian. I don't know why he's getting an invitation and I'm not.
Zoroaster was the first monotheistic god, so we're just, you know, piggybacking on his reputation.
Okay, fine.
Also, when did the Zoroastrians ever have a history of structural persecution of the Jews?
What have the Zoroastrians ever done for us?
Apart from give us really good scores at Scrabble that are then disputed because it's a proper noun.
I did just check. Captain Kirk is due to be born in 2233, so he'll be six by the deadline of the Messianic Age arriving. Or, you said it's the deadline, so maybe it's a little out, and actually, Kirk being born is the beginning of the Messianic Age.
Oh my god. That would be amazing. Either that or he's going to have one hell of a sixth birthday party.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who am I to decry the beliefs of your entire religion? So let's go with the Jewish Messianic Age as the world's best Messiah.
Yeah.
And I feel that's an overdue apology to Sam Liebens for his appearance on the show. Lovely. Well, done and dusted. Another five world's bests of world's worsts in the bank. Thank you, as ever, to everyone for listening to the show. You can find us on Twitter on @worstfoot, Ben's on @BenVandeveld, I'm on @BasMixDay, and we'll be back next week with more doom and gloom, more proper worsts and the like. Thank you as ever to everyone who's been getting in touch with various Patreon donations and things. I think we're fairly up to date with all of those, but again, just we appreciate everyone who has been donating this year, of all years especially. And to the people who've been writing nice reviews, we got a couple more nice reviews from various people in the USA I saw this week on iTunes. So if you've got a minute and you want to write a little two-line review of us saying nice things, that would be much appreciated. Right, old-fashioned for Ben, Shirley Temple for me.
Queen's greatest hits for both of us.
And we just sit here and wait for 219 years.
Okay.
For Captain Kirk to arrive. Thank you for listening to Worst Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.